I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Right now, the top films at the box office are Black Panther and A Wrinkle in Time. Those films mark the first time in history that the number one and number two movies in the country have black directors. The roaring success of Black Panther has led to a lot of comments about whether Hollywood might be changing, and if this movie and others like Get Out, another box office success with a black writer and director and a black star, might be ushering in a new era of multicultural representation in Hollywood. Our guest today has spent a lot of time looking deeply at the structure and culture of Hollywood, and she's here to share her insight. And not to splash water on the idea, but a lot of other things need to change before we're really going to reach the goal of a diverse and representational movie industry. Monica White-Ndunu is a professor in the Dartmouth College Theater Department. She's the author of Shaping the Future of African-American Film, Color-Coded Economics, and the Story Behind the Numbers, and she joins us now. Professor Ndunu, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Let me get it out there first. You've seen Black Panther, yes? Do you like it?
Yes. I've seen the film four times, and I love the film. So I actually just want to get that out there before I start talking about some of the other elements that we'll discuss today.
Why? Why is it important to get that out there?
Well, because I think there's a lot of excitement around the film. And I think very often any critique of a film or the moment may be perceived as an attack against the film or the moment. And so I think a lot of us who study this, very often we are sort of the wet blanket that come in and sort of dampen the excitement with the critique with when there isn't that understanding that all of this is to serve the movement that we would like to see happen and not necessarily to deter any of the excitement.
Well, the film, I mean, it is hard not to love Black Panther. Visually, the storyline, I mean, everything about it is sort of amazing. So why do you think it has resonated so loudly with so many different kinds of audiences beyond just the spectacle of this great film to be this moment, and especially for African-American audiences?
Well, I think there are several reasons for that. Number one, we have to keep in mind that the Black Panther film is part of the Marvel Universe, and so it's already bringing with it a ready-made audience of comic book fans and people who are familiar with the character and the universe that the character is featured in. So there's that element of it. Also, you do not very often get black leads in films of this type of genre of film. Very often black films are treated like a genre unto themselves when you can have a predominantly black cast in a horror film or a predominantly black cast in a sci-fi film or fantasy film. That can happen, but very often black films are defined by their race. And the genre that they are representing may get lost in popular discussions about the film. And so part of this is you have a film with a predominantly black cast with a $200 million budget, which means they have the resources to really make the film look and feel like a narrative that's taking place in the Marvel Universe. So there's that excitement that you can actually have a big budget, predominantly black cast film. And then it was just very well done. I think Ryan Coogler, his creative team, everybody who worked on this project should be very proud of what they produced. And that's what I think black audiences are tapping into. There's that, in addition to the anti-colonialist message within the film, which really resonates in the Black Lives Matter era.
So I mean, it seems like there are a lot of factors. Partly, it's this moment in time when the film was actually released, in addition to how big a film it is, how beautifully made, how expensively made, and this cast and the storyline. I mean, all of those things together have sort of played into this moment that Black Panther comes out in.
Exactly. And I think that's part of the excitement, too. We have, over the past several years, There's been video footage of unarmed black people being killed by the police or vigilantes, and justice not being served. So the idea of a black superhero, which again is not a new thing, we've had films with black superheroes before, but in this particular moment to have a film like Black Panther do so well, I think it does also speak to this moment.
So, Professor Ndunu, given your book, Shaping the Future of African-American Film, Color-Coded Economics and the Story Behind the Numbers, how do you think Black Panther fits into that narrative?
I think it's an exciting example of what could be, but it doesn't necessarily really reflect actual changes in Hollywood. So there are a lot of think pieces about how this film will change everything in Hollywood. And unfortunately, it will not. Not if we are just expecting the excitement from the film to do it. There are structural changes that need to take place within the industry in order to have this type of representation multiplied. So we can't expect one film to do it, to undo over 100 years of racist cinema or race ideology embedded in cinema and the way that the industry works. So one really good example of that is the UCLA. They released a report on February 28th, and the report was titled 5 Years of Progress and Missed Opportunities. And in this, it's the center that's headed by Dr. Darnell Hunt, and the report basically shows that there has been some progress in terms of trends behind the scenes in television, more so than film, in regards to people of color and women. And so part of what's happening now is we're looking at this film and we're saying, well, this proves that a black film can make money in the box office and in the global box office. And now this should be the evidence that's needed in order to garner more support for these types of films. But this is not the first time in history that we've had predominantly black cast films perform well. In fact, predominantly black cast films tend to perform well in the box office, and they often frequently make a profit in the domestic box office even before predominantly white cast films tend to do so.
Why is that? Because they're made more cheaply often with a lower budget?
Right. And so it's a catch-22 in a sense, because as a predominantly black cast film, it's not expected to perform at the same level as a predominantly white cast film. And so they're given lower budgets. And the benefit of that is with a lower budget, you can actually recoup your expenses more quickly than if you have a larger budget. And so there are some benefits to having a smaller budget, but there are also limitations. You couldn't make a film like Black Panther on the typical budget that a predominantly black cast film would receive. So that's why you tend to have a lot of these films that are, set in a particular time period or have certain elements, but they don't necessarily look like a Black Panther film, because you're not getting a $200 million budget to do to do that type of thing.
But why? I mean, if we think of Hollywood at its most base instincts is, out to make a buck, why wouldn't this be a great way for film studios and producers to think just on pure economics, hey, this is a great way for me to make money, and why don't we then see more films with black casts and black directors?
I think that's a great question, and that's one of the things that I explore in my book, Shaping the Future of African-American Film, because for me, I thought, well, if Hollywood knows this, and they've known this, this is not the fact that Black Panther performed so well was not a surprise to me, because, again, predominantly black cast films tend to perform well economically. So it was the ability to have performed so well, like so far beyond expectation in the domestic and the global box office. Like, that's an important thing. And when we began to really look at the numbers and see what is the return on investment in this film, that's what's going to make the difference in how we really understand its impact on the economic side. So I think part of the challenge with Hollywood and why they don't change, there is a race ideology, because no matter how well predominantly black cast films perform, there's still this perception that they don't perform well and they don't travel well overseas. So you had just recently, you had Girls Trip, performed very well. You've had films like Think Like a Man that also performed well and beyond expectations in its time. And very often these films, even if they perform well in the domestic office, box office, they won't necessarily get an international release. And so, again, you have to start thinking about, well, why, if they know that these films can make money, do they continue to perpetuate this idea? And it is tied to race, because, again, they do think about the race of the cast when they're casting or when they're providing, making investment decisions about films.
So it goes much beyond the economics. I mean, it really is either an ideology or a perception or a persistent perception that's not based on the reality of, you know, what quote unquote black films will do at the box office that's leading this direction, because it's not economics.
It's not. And one way you can kind of see how these things are trending is if you follow or if you look at the Ulmer scale. And how the Ulmer scale is basically a system that was designed by James Ulmer that identifies stars as A-list, B-list, C-list, or D-list stars. And you begin to see trends in which stars tend to be A-list stars. And so films are cast based on, you know, whether a star can raise, just on their name alone, their name recognition, if you can get the type of budget you would need to, you know, to produce the film, right? And so it's very much tied to casting, and casting is very much tied to race. And so one of the things that I consistently, you know, look at in the book is what types of structural changes would be needed in order to operate within the reality, which is that diversity sells, but it's not provided the sustained opportunity to do so that predominantly white cast films are provided.
Well, so when you talk about those structural changes, I'm assuming then some of it is that you need people with more diverse perspectives, namely people of color, in those deciding roles, in leadership roles. You need the people who hold the purse strings, who make the decisions about what kinds of films get made, to be people who have either a different perspective or, you know, who are more supportive and, in fact, more likely to push films with diverse perspectives or black casts or black directors.
Absolutely. And part of that, I think, also comes from the education, the ways in which we are taught the things that we learn in order to do our jobs. And so very often the way that these types of films and the filmmakers who are considered the greatest filmmakers, if you aren't teaching the work of women and people of color when you're teaching those things, when people are learning the business side, if they're not looking at the evidence, the data that's showing that diversity sells, then you continue to perpetuate that same mentality. And so a lot of things need to change within the system that people are already working in, so that you do have more people of color and women in positions of power that can, you know, bring some of these projects to fruition. But also we need to think about how we're training the next generation of artists and producers or executives that are going to be working in the industry, so that we can be tackling these issues on all sides.
So do you see that changing at all? I mean, do you see the structure changing? Do you see people in positions of power changing?
I believe there are people who are working in the industry right now who could make those changes, but how much access will they actually have to those positions of power that will enable them to make wholesale changes? I think we have a lot of work that needs to be done there. And so, again, like that the report was saying, the 5 years of progress and missed opportunities, you know, you have more progress that's taking place in television than in film. I think we really need to look at, you know, who's running the studios, who has the power to green light films, who has the access to these positions, and how do we create more access to these positions so that we have just a broader range of cultures represented, and we can actually make films that more accurately reflect the demographics of the United States as well as the rest of the world. But right now, the Hollywood film industry does not do that.
Today we're talking with Dartmouth Theater Professor Monica Whiten-Dunu. She's written about black representation in Hollywood and has been reflecting on what the success of Black Panther and other movies like Get Out, A Wrinkle in Time, and Moonlight have hailed for their diverse casts and African-American representation actually meant for the direction the film industry is going. Professor Ndunu, you mentioned earlier that TV seems to be a place where there's maybe more movement, more diversity, more experimentation, perhaps even. And I'm wondering where you see that and if TV is sort of a corollary to the film industry.
I think in general, you hear about people like Shonda Rhimes, who have had a significant influence in terms of creating shows that are more diverse in the casting. And as a showrunner and creator, she is in a more powerful position to make those types of decisions. And so I think even having outlets like Netflix or Hulu, you know, different streaming services, there seem to be different opportunities for women and people of color to develop projects that are, you know, represent a broader range of diversity.
Does it matter who the target audience is for films or TV? You know, for example, you think about Black Panther, and you talk about the films and this idea of a quote-unquote black movie, and perhaps the leaders in Hollywood saying, but that's just for black audiences, therefore it's not going to be a big blockbuster, when that's not entirely true and certainly does not reflect the reality of what kinds of films are of interest to broad audiences, whether or not they represent a life or a person who is familiar to the person who's going to the film.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting to me, because this is how you know that race ideology is a factor, because these same studio executives would never say that a predominantly white cast film is only for white people.
Right.
There's an assumption that somehow white means universal, and that in a white film with a white lead, and especially a white male lead, that anyone can identify.
Right. That's for everyone.
Right. And so I think that's where you have to get to the heart of that. And, you know, just really call that what it is, which is it's racist ideology to think that only this particular perspective is the one that all other cultural backgrounds have to enter in order to enjoy a film. And I think it also discredits white audiences to assume that somehow they aren't capable of having empathy with people of color, or being able to see the world through the eyes of a protagonist that may look different from themselves. People of color and women can have universal stories. Those stories are specific, just like a predominantly white cast film, you know, has a very specific story. And so you have to change the assumption and begin to look at all of us. We are human beings. Human beings come from different cultures or are part of different cultures. These different cultures have their, you know, worldviews that are shaped by those cultures, and those worldviews are articulated and expressed through the stories. But as human beings, we can access those stories through a range of characters, and that's the type of, I think, work that needs to be done when we're thinking about who's the audience for a film. But as of right now, Hollywood tends to identify audience predominantly as white or non-black, unless it's for specifically a black film.
Well, and can't that really affect what happens to that film? I mean, you can make whatever film you want, but then how it's distributed and how it's marketed is going to have a significant effect on who thinks of going to see it, who does go to see it, where they can see it, et cetera.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I found in the research I did for my book, which is that very often predominantly black cast films, they are not distributed at the same rate or on the same level as predominantly white cast films. And so it's actually pretty phenomenal that they're returning a profit with the limited, comparatively limited distribution that they're receiving based on the race of the cast of the film and the filmmaker. And this is, again, why I say you can't really, you can't detach the idea of race ideology and the way it's operating just when you look at how the system is operating, even on that very basic level.
Does that go for movies for kids, too? I mean, just as an example, you know, looking around the theaters over the last several months trying to find a theater that was playing Coco, it was really difficult to find in Vermont, but there are a lot of theaters playing Paddington.
Right.
And these are animated movies, you know,
right,
for kids.
Exactly. And again, I want to say Coco is an excellent film as well. And it was a refreshing point of view that was reflected in that film. And so, yeah. And then when you think about what are the larger implications of doing that, because when you make it that much harder for people to be able to access a film, you're almost you're actually contributing to the failure of the film rather than trying to promote its success. And if you're doing that based on the race that's represented in the film, then you can't, again, you cannot detach that from the race ideology that's driving that decision. And so Coco actually is done very well, and it is accessible and enjoyable for audiences from a variety of backgrounds. And so I think we can learn more from that and say we should make these films more accessible, because we're even sending messages to our kids what types of things that we find acceptable, what types of things we find to be the norm. And then we are also identifying for them difference and the things that should be treated differently when it, just in the way that the system is operating.
Let's go to Kermit, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Kermit. Go right ahead.
Hi. I wrote a what was originally a film, a historic fiction about ancient Egypt, and for Cicely Tyson, James Earl Jones, and it was picked up quite a few times and then adapted into a series. And it was a leading trend just recently, a couple of years ago. And it was passed over. Several other projects on ancient Egypt were picked up and produced. None of them had anything organic about Egypt involved in them. All white casts, including just everybody. And we were told to wait to see if everything bore out. But there was nothing organic about Egypt. They were just very expensive costume dramas. Mm-hmm. Complete fiction, complete disservice, nothing relevant to anything. And mine keeps getting, you know, passed over. Now, it's being picked up again, probably because of Black Panther. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to point out again that the criteria by which they decide whether or not they're going to develop your project or not, with the, you know, with an all with a cast of mixed people of color, mm-hmm. You know, different ethnicities, it really does work against you.
Hmm. Kermit, thanks for sharing your experience. What do you think about that, Professor Ndunu?
I am not surprised by that. And I think what we'll start to see now, based on the success of Black Panther, is we tend to have film cycles where you'll have one particular film that'll do really well, and then you'll have a series of films that follow that are either very similar to that film and or using people from the cast of that film. What comes to mind is the blaxploitation era of the 1970s, where initially you had Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, a film by Melvin Van Peebles, the film did very well, and it spawned a lot of Hollywood tried to reuse the formula to make a series of other predominantly black cast films. But what happened is once those films start to not perform as well and not have the same cultural resonance as the original film, those cycles die out. Now, that's the natural life cycle of film cycles. Like, film cycles do die out. But when it happens to predominantly black cast films, Hollywood will tend to say that, you know, it's the race of the films that nobody wants to see black films. When no, maybe it's they don't want to see that particular genre represented in film. They're looking for something else. And so I'm not surprised of this particular project. It has a predominantly black cast or a more mixed cast, and it's been rejected, and they're waiting to see how Black Panther does. It may have a better chance of being picked up now. That doesn't surprise me. There's a new film that just got greenlit, The Woman King with Viola Davis and Lupita Nyong'o. Also, Danai Gurira and Lupita Nyong'o will star in Americana. And all of these were announced following, you know, the success of Black Panther. So you'll probably get a series of predominantly black cast films. And this is why I caution people to say, don't get excited, because what will happen when these films are not performing as well at some point, as most film cycles do, is they will start to say, oh, well, you know, that trend is over. But they never slow down the rate of the production of predominantly white cast films. That is a constant. So, again, we have to continue to push for the changes behind the scenes that will allow for the projects like the one that was described by the caller, Kermit. We have to push for the type of change behind the scenes that will allow those projects to make it through.
Let's go to another call here. Emma is with us from Colchester. Hi, Emma. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. So I just wanted to call in. I'm thrilled that you guys took up this topic. I could talk about this for hours, but I've written several academic papers about the impact of comic book superheroes in society, and I think that we've barely scratched the surface of the positive impact that Black Panther is going to have just in the terms of the inherent universal truth of superheroes, that they must be accepted by society as someone who is doing things for society's good in order to be successful superheroes. And so Black Panther, in the success of the box office and just the visibility that they've gained, is now among the ranks of Captain America and Batman and Superman. And that has wildly incredible potential on a pedagogical approach, but also just in a day-to-day pop culture approach, just in everyone's daily life.
Emma, thanks for your call. And, you know, Professor Ndunu, we're talking here about the structure of Hollywood, and Black Panther doesn't change the structure of Hollywood. But, you know, Emma's saying, beyond that, the actual fact of this movie and the characters and what they represent, and having people of color represent these characters in the Marvel Universe, and this idea of doing good and being in the world, and all of this that T'Challa represents, is meaningful and impactful. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. I think this fact should not be lost. This is an important film in that regard. And also in terms of, I mean, I could literally speak for days about just very specific elements of the film that I found fascinating and that I think warrant further discussion. And I think there have been a lot of pieces written about that aspect of it, and I applaud those pieces. At the same time, my role in this, my intervention is to say it's a both-and situation, that yes, there are very important things about this film that we must keep in mind and that we can use to teach and, you know, just also to really think about the society and, you know, like where we are in this moment and where we're going, right? But the intervention I'm making is to say that if we honestly believe that the performance of this single film is going to completely change the system, mm-hmm. then we really need to go back and study the film industry over time and have a better understanding of how it operates and how these types of successes for people of color tend to be reabsorbed back into Hollywood so it can sustain itself as it operates. It does not tend to change based on these films. And again, if you want to look at it in terms of women, when Thelma and Louise came out in the 1990s, there was a belief that somehow it was going to change everything for women in film. And here we are in the Me Too movement, when we're still looking at the disparities in terms of women in positions of power. So I think that is an excellent point, and I think we should continue to celebrate that. But at the same time, we should understand this side of it as well.
Nessa is calling in from Reigate Corner. Hi, Nessa. You're on the air.
Hi. I just had to laugh because I was going to bring up the Thelma and Louise point myself. I appreciate the professor's point about the core of the problem being the lack of diversity at power levels in Hollywood because of ingrained perception and prejudice. So we see how it works not only with diversity of races, but also with women and, I might add, older folks. The success of the Marigold Hotel movie, for example, was this huge surprise, and yet it wasn't followed by other movies who showed dominant casts of older people. So getting a change in the power structure of Hollywood is absolutely essential, which is why TV has been more vibrant in that direction, because there is beginning to be more diversity at the levels that things get made.
Nessa, thanks for your call and comments. Professor Ndunu, you agree?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really interesting point in terms of the representation of older characters on film. There should be more of that. And when you see, like, Hollywood is very often youth-obsessed, you get a lot more attention paid to, you know, that target audience, that demographic, you know, which in certain ways is understandable if you're considering just the numbers they get reported of who's watching what type of film. But again, if you are actually trying to, there is still a market for these films with older casts. And so we have to begin to look at the different strategies of, if we can, you know, better representing the demographics of the nation, which has a range of people and a range of ages. And that's not even, we haven't even gotten into the representation of LGBTQ on film as well. So,
yeah, I mean, certainly there representation, there are plenty of places to go with that question and whose viewpoints are being expressed, whose stories are being told, Indigenous people, for example, as well. But so,
right.
So if the question is not, or if the solution for people who don't work in Hollywood is not just buy tickets, you know, it's, if it's not just ticket sales are going to change the minds of Hollywood producers, because once they see a movie making money, they'll say, let's make more of that. If that's not the solution, what can regular old moviegoers do in this kind of situation to try to help guide or push or force change in Hollywood?
Yeah, I think part of it is, this is one of the reasons why, I'm cautioning against suggesting that this film is going to change everything. One thing I do want to note is that we are in a very specific moment where I think people can push for more change, and it's through these movements like Me Too, Time's Up, Black Lives Matter. So part of this is very much tied to our society, you know, and so it's like we have to begin to think differently about what types of stories are going to represent us as a nation and as people in general. And there's the aspect of supporting those films and those filmmakers, but then also, you know, trying to produce our own work. You have a lot of people who are very much interested in trying to tell a different type of story. And our job then is to, through these movements, try to push for better access for people who are trying to make the types of projects that we want to see and support. And then even also investing. You know, there are people who are trying to raise money online through different campaigns to develop their work, and then developing different distribution models. And so I think we have to look at every stage of the production and distribution process and see at what stage and what place we can intervene. Even as regular people, we can find different points of intervention where we can help truly shape the future of what our film industry would look like.
Monica White Ndunu is a professor in the Dartmouth College Theater Department, and she's the author of Shaping the Future of African American Film, Color-Coded Economics, and the Story Behind the Numbers. Professor Ndunu, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Me too.